Okay, thank everyone for coming today. I'm Lisa with the Alaska World Affairs Council. And if you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program is being recorded for KSKA. And so if you don't mind turning your cell phones off, that'll be great for our listeners at home. I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording today of our program. And if you'd like to hear a copy of this program, you can go onto the alaskapublic.org website, where it will be available for download next week. You can see all of our previous programs at alaskapublic.org. I'd like to thank our speaker today for speaking this morning to some students at McLaughlin Youth Center. She spoke to some youth about understanding and relations, and it was a very good conversation for some folks who really appreciated her time. So thank you very much for doing that. I'd also like to recognize some students. If we have any students here today, if you could please stand and be recognized. Fabulous. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for coming. We hope to see you again soon. And thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our student program, which allows students to come at no charge thanks to BP. So please tell your friends and come back again. Do we have any first-time Alaska World Affairs Council visitors? Besides the students, if you could raise your hand. Is anybody new? Okay. Wonderful. Great. I'm so glad you came. And next week, we will have these problems fixed, we hope. We'll be in the other room across the way, where we will feature John Hatch, who's the founder of Finca, a microfinance loan company. And he's going to be talking about ending poverty by 2040. And now at this time, I'd like to bring to the podium a special person who's going to be introducing our speaker, Dr. Shannon from UAA, if you could come to the mic.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. And thank you to the Alaska World Affairs Council for having such a timely event this week. It is my very great pleasure to introduce to you today our distinguished guest and speaker, Ambassador Shireen Tahir Kelly. Dr. Tahir Kelly began her career as a professor of political science at Temple University, which is where I got my PhD, so go Owls. She very quickly established herself as an expert on Indian-Pakistani relations. She then joined the Reagan administration in 1982, where she worked as a member of the policy planning staff at the Department of State. From 1984 to 1989, she served on the National Security Council, where she served as the Director of Political Military Affairs, and then as Director of Near East and South Asian Affairs. President George H.W. Bush then appointed her as the alternate U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations for Special Political Affairs from 1990 to 1993, and this made her the first Muslim American with ambassadorial level status in the United States. During the Clinton years, she then went back into academia, but she returned to government in 2001 as the head of the U.S. delegation to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva. She then joined the National Security Council as the Senior Director for Democracy, Human Rights, and International Operations from 2003 to 2005. She was then Senior Advisor for the Secretary of State for UN Reform, and finally served as the Senior Advisor for Women's Empowerment, which focused largely on Muslim women, to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And this last position was especially crucial to the Bush administration's policy of democracy promotion. So you can see from all of this that she is a very distinguished and very experienced policy expert. And I can tell you from my own experience that we're in for a real treat today. I actually was able to interview Shireen about her role in the George W. Bush administration for my own book project. And it was the Alaska World Affairs Council that brought us together. Last year, Ambassador Peter Thompson came up here to speak about his book on Afghanistan. And I had breakfast with him the next morning, and he asked me about my research. And he said, oh, I should put you in touch with my friend Shireen. And he did, which I was very grateful for. And she very graciously accepted my request to interview her. And I can honestly say from that interview that she is one of the most accomplished and impressive women that I've ever met. So I went all the way to Alaska to go back to Philadelphia and meet someone who lived 5 minutes from my old house. but I just want to, you know, let you guys know that she is going to be a really incredible speaker for us. So thank you for flying all of this way. And without further ado, I give you Ambassador Shireen Tahir Kelly.
introduction. Close to my mouth. Okay. And thank you, Lisa. This is, for me, a special occasion. It's my first trip to Alaska. In the last few months, I've had two interactions. First, the time we met in Pennsylvania County, and now I'm here. So this is obviously my Alaska year. And I want to thank the World Affairs Council for this wonderful invitation. The salmon is very good. I did get to taste it. Come out on a Friday afternoon to talk about an issue like this is, of course, very heartwarming. I also am grateful to this audience for making the time to focus on an important issue which influences how we think and act towards a subject which in this globalized world affects all of us and where geography is no longer a barrier to understanding. Thank you. That makes it a little bit easier. That's why you head the organization. You know how to solve problems. Since I received this invitation to speak some months back, I have been thinking about how I might synthesize a huge subject into a 35-minute talk. After all, there are over 1.75 billion Muslims who reside in 49 countries covering all parts of the world. Islam is the second largest religion after Christianity. 25% of the world's population is Muslim. Islam is the world's fastest growing religion. Given my own personal and professional experience, I am going to address this issue in terms of Muslims in nation states and as non-state actors. I want to focus on why it even matters that we in the US should care about Muslim societies. What are the factors we might do something to influence? What elements do we have little or no control over? Finally, what are some of the implications for US foreign policy? Let me start at the personal level. When I first came to the United States at the age of 15 from Pakistan, I came to go to university, Ohio Wesleyan. My religion was hardly an issue in 1959, although I was well aware that I was one of only two foreign students, the other being a German girl in Delaware, Ohio. But there was interest in my background, in the life that I had lived before arriving as a citizen in the United States much later. I was invited into homes, churches, schools, Rotary clubs, etc., to talk about Pakistan and found responsive audiences. Delaware was a small town in the Midwest. I found people with big hearts and warm hospitality. Despite what I assumed to be a sophisticated beginning in this country, there were of course moments of comedy for a young 15-year-old Muslim girl who became a junior and graduated at 16 from university. I looked older, and my roommate was ever annoyed that she was often asked to show her ID if you ever went out in the evening, and I was not. Whenever she protested, the response pointing to me was, "She looks fine." Some years later, after a return to Pakistan, marriage, and then moved back to the US with my husband, who was a postdoctoral fellow in physics at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, my career path led me in a different direction. I served on the faculty of the U.S. Army War College. This was in between my, actually just after I got tenured at Temple University, which Kevin mentioned, and I'm happy to go into my early experiences if you are interested in the questions part of it. But it was interesting that this issue of my religion sort of began to surface about the time because it was, the curiosity factor sort of began to emerge. Because I was told I was the first female Muslim ever to have joined the ranks of the U.S. Army War College faculty. I recall one particular sort of incident. It wasn't too long into my tenure there, where the U.S. Army War College is a college which is a sort of a place there where up-and-coming officers at the rank generally of colonels go before they go to become, you know, one-star general. And so I was working with somebody in the strategic studies part of it, teaching strategic studies issues. I was working with the Pentagon, the J5, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs Office, on the planning side for what became the Central Command. So I was, you know, going back and forth between Carlisle and the Pentagon. And there weren't that many women, let alone women who looked like me, sort of doing that at the time. And the Army War College also had fellows from the militaries of other countries. There were some 20 countries represented, and these were also colonels, sometimes brigadier generals who came for the year. And some of them came with their spouses, so their wives were there. So I remember one briefing I was in this big room, which was the auditorium, which was by the very, very smart Army colonels, was called the bedroom because they all came there and went to sleep. But, and the lights were dimming, and there'd been a Marine guard at the doorway, obviously checking clearances as you went in because it was a classified briefing. And the lights went low, and there was a visiting three-star, whose name I will not mention, who was the distinguished guest there. And then he looked around, and he saw this woman sitting with these 30 men, and the woman wasn't who you'd expect, probably, at the Army War College on the faculty. So he looked, and he turned to me, and he said, quite quietly, "Do you have a clearance, security clearance?" So, of course, it was a very, the War College was a very gallant place, and everybody who was there from the college began to feel very nervous. And so they must have said something to him, and he turned to me again, and he said, "Oh." I said, "Yes." And he turned to me, and he said, "I'm so sorry. I thought you were somebody's wife." And I said, "I am." Which, of course, led to a lot of laughter. The man felt embarrassed. And I thought, I'm not going to make a fuss of this. I mean, you know, these things happen. The glass is half full rather than empty. And we went on to become good friends. And when I went into government, and I needed not a favor for me personally, but we were trying to get something from the Pentagon, which even when you work for the President of the United States, you go and say, "The President would like," they say, "Oh, yeah." So I sort of said, "I know somebody," and he was in that position. And because he said to me, "If I can ever help you," I said, "Sir, you remember you had said?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, we need a favor now." And I got it. So you see, the half full is always a good idea. But this was a digression to tell you that the Muslimness or the difference in those days was an asset. In my personal life, it remained one. But the impression of America and Americans, and I was at the policymaking end and working with the president's staff, so it was a very high-level focus over there, began to change. And I think two of the events that I can point to in my career experience that began to focus this aspect of interest, concern about Muslim societies, were the two events actually occurred 79-80. One was, of course, the overthrow of the Shah of Iran and his replacement by a theology of Ayatollahs. And the fact that there was a religious elite now taking over a country which was considered a strategic, relocated friend of the United States. And then, of course, the then Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. And that sort of combination, with both events being of concern to the United States, made it very much an issue of, you know, the Muslimness or the outside world. I would say that America's focus on the Cold War had meant engagement with the Muslim world. There were friends and perceived neutrals and even foes in that war. But it was always in terms of what a nation as a state actor was doing or not willing to do in the U.S. interest. The policy focus remained the ruling elites and governments of Muslim countries. Even as the United States gave economic assistance, the goal of which was development of various countries and economic progress, governments in respective countries got to decide the priorities and the pace of economic assistance within the allocated amount. After all, assistance does not displace sovereignty. Throughout the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s, U.S. foreign policy sought friends in the Muslim world, encouraged people-to-people contact through academic exchanges, student exchanges, trade, assistance, but at the policy level, largely. Muslim societies were not a major focus. The U.S. academic world, of course, had its experts, for example, Professor Fazlur Rahman at the University of Chicago, Bernard Lewis at Princeton University. Being a Muslim in America at many levels was still unique until the last decade. For example, when I was sworn in as a U.S. ambassador by Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger in July 1990 to go on to the UN to represent the U.S., the protocol people at the State Department were very, very excited about the fact that, as they said, I was the first Muslim, male or female, in U.S. history to become an American ambassador. During my service at the National Security Council from 1984 to 1990, I often heard about the unique situation I was in. As I mentioned earlier, there were not too many women at the White House serving in key positions at the time. And I used to joke in the early months of my appointment that President Reagan probably thought that I'd been left behind by some visiting delegation to the Oval Office. I guess I said it often enough that at one point, on one day after a meeting, the president asked me to stay behind for a minute and said, "Shirin, I do know who you are. And no, I do not think you were left behind." So, but you know, it was the comment I'd made in jest, but it represented sort of the unusualness. And I note all of the above to give you not only a window into my own experience, but to point to the fact that the unique was an acceptable term in those days. America as a nation had not had any personal experience at the hand of Muslims where its psyche had been badly touched. September 9th, 2001 changed all that dramatically. The how and why of that awful act of terror against the homeland forced a laser-like focus on Muslim societies. The prevailing question, as asked by many, including Condoleezza Rice and others, and I heard so often, was, what led the terrorist hijackers of the three flights that hit the World Trade Towers, the Pentagon, and took it into the ground in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, to spend their life and give up their lives for destruction rather than build a productive life as engineers, computer specialists, doctors, etc.? As the global war on terror got going, peeling off Muslim societies from the clutches of the terrorists and their leading proponents such as Al-Qaeda came into sharp relief. Also at the same time, the often negative and strange commentary about Muslims became more central to the political discourse amongst the political chattering class. Past close cooperation between the U.S. and many Muslim countries was often forgotten by both sides as the turmoil of the post-9/11 got underway. Thereafter, one began to hear increasingly generalized statements about the nature of Islam, Muslim societies, and the us versus them approach that came to symbolize so much of the discourse. For example, as Professor Sharifa Zahur catalogs in a very interesting monograph written from the U.S. Army War College that I had served in so long ago, entitled Precision in the Global War on Terror, Inciting Muslims Through the War of Ideas, a number of common themes emerge, which I want to cite below to give you a sense of the scope and depth of the criticism of Muslims and Muslim societies. First, as part of the attempt to reshape the Muslim world, all types of Islamists are treated as militant fundamentalists, linking distinct aspects of Islamic thought to terrorism. Second, as the excellent essay by Vartan Gregorian details, Islam is a mosaic, not a monolith. Islam covers 49 countries in various parts of the world. While the source of the religion, the Quran, is shared throughout the Muslim world in terms of formal religion, Muslims live their lives differently in different places to a great extent. History, divisions, for example, the sectarian differences between Shia and Sunnis, culture, etc., all have a bearing on the population. Yet, the media tends to lump all Muslims together. policy communities also find it easier to deal with a comprehensive model. Third, as Mehmood Mamdani's treatise, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, denotes, often the key division among radical Islamist intellectuals concerns the status of Sharia Islamic law, which some say needs to be taken into account, changing, evolving circumstances with capacity for interpretation, ijtihad, and others noting that the gates of ijtihad remain forever closed. This tension plays out and is reflected in the dire forecast by political elites, even in the U.S. in recent years, that the Muslims of America are simply waiting to push for Sharia law across the United States. There are even websites and organizations that ask for and spend funds and lead political campaigns on what, to my mind, is a really bogus issue. This is the Islamo-fascism that links Muslims with the imposition of Sharia and establishment of a caliphate in the United States. Most Muslims find the berating of the faith for supposed fascist tendencies both untrue and deeply insulting. Fourth, as a particular version of jihadist ideology has become well known, we speak of global jihad to denote a strategic discovery aimed at protecting us from future attacks. In the process, we lump a large number of Muslims into the category of potential enemies of the West. Fifth, the overarching concept militant Islamist fails to cover the wide diversity of causes for militancy. The broad brushstroke identifies the absence of democracy as a root cause for extremism and fashions U.S. foreign policy in favor of democracy promotion in the Muslim world. Sixth, unlike other major religions, only Muslims are told that they are good Muslims and bad Muslims. Further criticism is based on select cultural, religious, intellectual principles. This is a concept characterized as theologocentrism, attributed to all observable phenomena among Muslims to matters of Islamic ideology, as detailed and analyzed in an essay by Asad Abu Khalil. Seventh, there are secular instincts and believers in the Muslim world who are often put on the defensive, even as they disagree amongst themselves about religiosity, cultural differences, and the best path forward. The West does not often recognize that some Islamists are simply chasing political power, while others are not. Eighth, Westerners assume that the clergy plays exactly the same role in the Muslim world as they do in Christianity, which is not the case. The above list is far from comprehensive, but I wanted to illustrate the language of disagreement that often defines the parameters of understanding. Next, I want to focus on why understanding Muslim society matters. At so many levels, how we interact with those people and states that are different is essential in this very interdependent world. U.S. interests are global in economic, strategic, political, and diplomatic terms. In an era where military might must be enhanced through collaboration, we cannot spend insufficient numbers to take on the onus of our global agenda unilaterally. Building strength through support internationally is critical. That is why so many American programs have looked at and tried to build relationships with Muslim countries. In the past, that support for U.S. priorities was sought from regimes and rulers. Today, there is a greater possibility of helping build bridges to civil society through the use of what is termed smart power. However, reaching out to the Muslim world means, first and foremost, that we respect each other's history and religion. We need to be cognizant of past achievements, even as we criticize current practices. Muslim societies have had many achievements and led the world at another time in a number of areas. Let me elucidate on just some of them here. I learned of the attitude of Islam towards science from my father, Dr. Azizuddin Siddiqui. He was educated in the traditional schools of Hyderabad, India, but also went on for higher education to Cambridge University in the United Kingdom, to academic institutions in France, and received his PhD in mathematical physics from the University of Leipzig in Germany, where he studied with the stars of his era, Heisenberg, Einstein, and Dirac. He He spoke 6 languages, 3 Eastern, 3 Western, fluently. His work and treatise on thermodynamics won him international acclaim and a nomination for the Nobel Prize. He received the Nehru Gold Medal for Science and innumerable awards for his life's work from many other countries around the world, as detailed in an account in a book on him recently written by Dr. Anwar Dil. My father taught me that one of the great achievements of history was Islam's attitude towards learning, that is, the universal right to knowledge. In today's era of compulsory and free education and the recognition of fundamental human rights, people are apt to forget that for a long time in human history, learning was considered to be the exclusive privilege of a certain restricted class. This was a class of religious leaders. Islam changed all this by abolishing priesthood and making it obligatory on all believers to acquire knowledge for themselves. This may not seem such a big deal now, but the democratization of knowledge with the consequent liberation of the human spirit was a great revolution in human affairs. In the very first verse of the Quran revealed to him, the Prophet of Islam was directed to read. The importance of reading, on reading, writing, and acquiring knowledge has been expounded in the verse in the most forceful way, pressing for its acquisition even if one had to go to distant places in search of it. Islam thus sanctified knowledge. Islam's attitude towards the scientific method is also a contribution worth noting. In the early days of civilization, man was used to taking things at their face value. As time passed and his consciousness developed, he acquired knowledge by experience. His knowledge consisted of a catalog of events. He was not yet at a point of drawing inferences or making predictions. Greek philosophers attached importance to reason, thinking, but mostly ignored observation. The Quran appealed to reason and experience. Again and again does the Quran lay stress on travel, observation, and contemplation. To quote, observe what is in the heavens and in earth. Do you not think? Do you not contemplate? Islamic origins of the scientific method are now recognized by Western historians such as Brifo, Bacon, and others. They note that in Islam there is no asceticism and that people are encouraged to use all resources for the betterment of humankind and in pursuit of knowledge. The work of scholars such as George Sarton is bringing into focus the achievements of Muslims in various branches of knowledge throughout the Middle Ages. The Arabs started to work on arithmetic in the 8th century. Their first task was to systematize the use of numerals now permanently associated with their name. The zero was mentioned probably for the first time in the arithmetical work of Al-Khwarizmi in the 9th century. Arabs contributed greatly to rational numbers consisting of fractions, developed various types of numbers, and developed the science of algebra. Al-Biruni, Ibn al-Haytham, and Umar al-Khayyam were great mathematicians in the 10th and 11th centuries, respectively. Astronomy is claimed by the Arabs as their own special subject. Even at the start of Islam, Muslims possessed sufficient astronomical knowledge to use the position of stars in their wanderings and in agriculture. A number of observatories built in the 9th century in various centers of learning such as Baghdad, Isfahan, etc., plus more than a dozen in various parts of the empire, all led to the development of instruments and resulted in the leap of understanding. From Genghis Khan to the Mughal emperors, support for astronomy led to discoveries and development of instruments that contributed mightily to the human knowledge and understanding. It is a history that Muslims are rightly proud of and non-Muslims appreciate. I have given you just a small taste of the achievements of Muslim peoples. There is also a huge contribution made more recently in arts, architecture, literature. Yet, post-industrial revolution, as the West sprang into progress, the Muslim world was left behind. These lands did contribute, however, to the overall success of the Western world. Colonialism became the vehicle which required conquest and occupation of so many parts of the Muslim world, which sustained the colonial masters. The history of the interaction between the West and the Islamic worlds may well have been different entirely, absent colonial empires. Given that history, U.S. history has had nothing to do, of course, with colonial conquests. Americans are thus often puzzled at the vehemence of populations in the Muslim world and their feelings against American policy. as Pew Research polls have recently indicated or indicated over the last decade, positive feelings of Muslims in a variety of countries have declined steadily. Is that a result of religion, history, culture, educational ignorance? My own sense is that history has a large share in the negative feelings and also spill over into negative feelings about the US. Many feel that the US is now the new, and I think this is a mistaken belief, but they nonetheless hold it, that it has become a country which launches foreign wars and subsequent occupation, however limited in duration. And this kind of a feeling, of course, complicates US interaction with the Muslim world. In addition, the growth of what is now termed the non-state actor as a force in international politics also complicates understanding and links the Muslim world, understanding and links with the Muslim world. After 9/11, the role of groups such as Al-Qaeda, with tentacles in so many parts of the Muslim world, makes the demise of such groups the first priority of American policy. In order to defeat this enemy, the outside powers have had to expend a great deal of blood and treasure, while the indigenous militant groups receive support from the population, whose cooperation they must have in order to hide and threaten the West. This is not simply the Huntington noted clash of civilization. It is a fundamental shift in the definition of civilization itself. This is not the nation state which provides the underpinning of modern diplomacy. This is a group of people wanting to take the world back to the Middle Ages. They do not have the support of the majority of citizens in the states in which they operate, yet they threaten to turn the silent majority in those states that is against their method into a silent minority. The recent start of what is termed as the Arab Spring, with the overthrow of dictatorial regimes in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and beyond, was greeted with some relief because it implied a different and more participatory future for the people of those lands. American leaders noted that no single day or event can instill democracy in a hurry, but people themselves were now demanding at the end of self-serving regime and access to benefits long denied. Armed with little more than their determination, these peoples fought at great cost for their rights. Women stood shoulder to shoulder with men to fight for a better future. They used the technologies of social media to outmaneuver the armies. They paid a price in blood but demanded radical change. For many Americans, the daily sights and excited commentary from countries in turmoil in the Muslim world sparks excitement but also fear. How can one be sure of future alliances? Who will be the next target of wrath from the people? How can the US interests in strategic terms be protected around the world as known regimes fall and uncertain futures come into focus? These are all crucial questions, and I'm sure many an American official is seized with finding the answer. For the rest of us, we need to understand that history does not stand still, that diversity in the Muslim world is a better guarantor of range of opinion. There are many who want a future where the citizens have access to basic needs such as housing, food, education, and minimum wages. Women comprise 50% of the population in the Muslim world, and I believe are especially keen to see a future where their daughters, along with their sons, have the better life than that which they lived. In many an important Muslim country, demographics is also a factor. Where 40% of the population is below the age of 30, the pressure for education, jobs, and survival becomes paramount. It took the frustration of a street vendor who had it with the security establishment of his country to light a match to end his own life. He died, but the spark resulted in a change of regime in Tunisia and has spread beyond. Muslims themselves, of course, have to decide what sort of future they want. An Islamic utopia, something open to the world? Do they want democracy? The majority of Muslims condemn terrorism. More Muslims have died in Muslim countries as a result of terrorism, violence perpetrated by Muslims against Muslims. In the end, I do believe that we need to be mindful of change, even if we do not always understand it. We need to ensure that these United States, built with the help and participation of so many religions and ethnic minorities, a beacon to all immigrants, stays studiously away from scapegoating Muslims living in our midst. Remember, as noted by Clinton Bennett, that in certain ways, Muslims are the same everywhere, yet their societies are different everywhere. Some countries in the Muslim world, such as Turkey, chose a secular path, but secularization does not necessarily result in a decline of religion. Islam is the personal compass for 99% of the Turks. At the end, it is hard to address the issue relating to Muslim societies this week without some thoughts on whether the U.S. should be involved overseas. And after watching the news yesterday, today, and a couple of days before that, the question that keeps cropping up is, why bother? Should we be involved overseas? Does the Muslim world matter? Should we even be spending any of our effort, our energies, and our treasure? While a valid question, I think that to remove ourselves from the good and the bad in the world requires that we become a different kind of America. That would be an America forfeiting its exceptional place as a global power. It also means no power projection, no strategic links and needs, no economic ties or dependence. Fortress America is a different country. A manifest destiny does not stop at the water's edge. It does not fade before national boundaries. Until such a choice is made, we are a part of the international community where Muslim societies remain a part of the picture. Thank you for being here. I'm delighted to take questions if you have any and if the time permits. Thank you again.
Just wanted to give everyone an update who's been so patient. The Hilton apologizes deeply for such the delay. There has been a problem in the entire hotel today. I'm sure we'll all read about it in the paper tomorrow. They have promised food. It is very late, but it is coming, they promise. They're also offering vouchers on everybody's way out for a free meal as you leave. So they apologize greatly. Ambassador Shireen Tahir Khalil has offered to answer some questions, so now is your opportunity, and please do stay. We will keep on going a little bit longer, and the food will be coming. Sorry for the problems. And she's requested, if you wouldn't mind leaving your name and or saying your name when you ask a question, and
Maynard Tapp.
You go ahead. Okay.
How do you see the growth in the demographics of the younger people is in the Islamic world affecting the ability to come about with a maybe a more peaceful way of moving forward?
Domestic, internally, development. The pressure on population and limited resources makes it hard. As any, not just the leader of a given country, but as people sort of write about different parts of the world, that is the challenge. And some say it's education, but education then means you have to create the economic opportunities for people. I mean, having an entire population of medical doctors with no place of practice isn't exactly a recipe for stability. So you've got to sort of manage, it's become in this sort of fast-moving, 24-hour news cycle, twittering era to provide the resources, to provide the institutions for development, and then opportunities for employment, all are challenges. So I think they're going to be sort of, you know, there's some countries that have resources that will likely at least be advantaged in providing that mix of three things. But if they don't, there's going to be sort of a lot of internal turmoil. And some of the Arab Spring is actually related to the control over the mechanisms of power and the resources of the country and the fact that, you know, large segments of the population are completely left out. And the demand for change is going to have to be accompanied by some portion, some sharing of that. And how it plays out, I don't know. I mean, the recipe could work out. It could also be very, very difficult. Yes, sir, there was a question back there.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Ambassador. My question is twofold. Exactly what does that understanding of promoting Muslim understanding in the United States, and what is your position with promoting that understanding in the UN with respect to the disparities of Arabs or Muslims in the Gaza and in the West Bank? And with respect to Sharia, what is it exactly, is it your department doing with respect to demonstrating an understanding of Sharia, which is actually more probably more aligned with values of the Republican Party and with values of programs, children's programs, like even Sesame Street?
Well, I think there's a slight sort of disconnect here. I did represent the United States as an ambassador to the UN, did not work for the UN, so I don't have a department that, the only department I worked for was the President of the United States, and that department changes. So, I'm actually a happily retired person, occasionally forays out. But yeah, it was a high achievement, I assure you. But I think the question you ask is, what does one do with disparity? And I can't speak to one versus other. For me, a disparity is a disparity one place versus as it is in any other. And as a Muslim and as an American, what worries me, and this is at a personal level, this is a human level, this has got nothing to do with any government or institution. Disparities that occur within societies at the hand of their own governments bother me a lot more in many ways. Because you first have to put your own house in order to some extent before you can sort of worry about the greater good. And I can see the frustration, I mean, having worked a little bit in my working life on with particularly women's sort of groups who felt disadvantaged, left out, and they're not just universally in the Muslim world, they're everywhere, including some in the United States, that the opportunity, the creation of opportunity for people is one of the big challenges of every government. Some manage it better, some not. And in the Muslim world, the disparities for women have been really telling. And it disappoints me hugely. I hope it changes. At least people, since the 2003-04 Arab Human Development Report, which focused on women, people have begun, the conversation has at least begun. The resources are beginning to be applied. Even in countries that have large resources, it had not been a priority. So that sort of thing needs to be fixed before other things. Sharia law is, as I said, you know, it's an ideal that some people talk about, but it is not something that I've ever heard anybody seriously in any country, Muslim country even, let alone in this country, sort of say this is going to become a caliphate with the application of an ideal model for another era today. So I think it is a disservice to sort of reduce our issues on the subject of understanding a different religion to something that's just a non-existent issue. There are other things that might be focused, but this one is not one that I think warrants any further serious discussion.